And now, more tips with your host, Rebecca, on lifestyle improvement.
And remember that in our program, we present our opinion and the opinion of our guest, and it's not to be interpreted as medical advice. Hello, and welcome to our program, Lifestyle Improvement. Today, we have the pleasure to have with us Dr. Lisa Gaylor. Dr. Gaylor is faculty at the University of Virginia School of Nursing. She has a psychology PhD from UCLA, where she studied gut and liver interactions with the brain. She followed that with postdoctoral studies in comparative anatomy of the autonomic nervous system. And then she became involved in her current field of psychoneuroimmunology, studying how the immune system and the brain communicate. I had the pleasure to see Dr. Gaylor speak about exactly that, the interaction between the brain and the gut. And I thought I would be so happy if she joined us at Lifestyle Improvement, because us as caregivers, we can use all the help that we can get. And we think about food, we think about nutrition, but I'm not sure that we all know that communication between the gut and the brain. So Dr. Gaylor was so wonderful to say yes to our invitation. And here you are all the way from Virginia via Skype. Hello, Dr. Gaylor. How are you?
Hello. I'm wonderful. I'm very pleased to be here with you.
Fantastic. You know, when I went to your workshop and I heard the information that you had to share, I just had to bring it here to the program because it's so important. I am not sure that a lot of us know the connection between the gut and the brain. And the workshop that you go and you share all over the United States, understanding the gut-brain, stress, appetite, digestion, and mood is something we all need to hear about. So tell us, you use the term gut-brain. What do you mean with that?
Well, that's a really good question. It turns out that we have millions and millions of nerve cells, neurons in our gut. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's about as many as there are in the spinal cord. So that's a lot of neurons. And you know, some of your audience may have heard this term, the gut brain, before. If you get on the internet, you may hear about people saying all our moods and all of our memories in our gut brain. and it makes people maybe think that there's something like a little brain that's in our gut. Uh-huh. And sometimes people talk about it like it's that way, but it's really not like that. The gut is really a giant long tube, and it has to do a bunch of things, including digest our food. It has to be able to move the food from our mouth all the way down through, and that has to be coordinated in a way that we prefer not to have to do consciously. It'd be really difficult. We'd spend all of our life if we had to do that consciously. So we have all these neurons that together collaborate to take care of all those things that we don't need to take care of. So people call it a brain because it has all of the things that you need to have for a brain. If you think of what you need for a brain, you have to be able to know what's going on in the environment, right? You have to be aware of that. Uh-huh. And you have to be able to interact with it, you know, make movements or things right. that you need to do. And then you have to have some way of deciding what to do based on what's happening. And so the gut brain has all of those things, but it's just distributed. So it's a whole bunch of little collections of neurons that are all connected up together. And they're sort of specialized for what they do. And they all talk to each other. So it's important to keep them healthy.
That's fantastic. And thank you for explaining that, because I think, like I said, not a lot of us are aware that that connection is there. So tell me, what is really stress and how does it affect the hidden brain in your gut?
Oh, that's a giant question. You know, we all sort of think we know about what stress is. I mean, if people will say, oh, I'm so stressed, or you look stressed, or and when we think about that kind of stress, we're usually talking about psychological stress. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, if you're a caregiver, if, you know, you're tired, or if the person you're taking care of is taking a turn for the worse, or they're having more challenges, that's stress. Mm-hmm. That can be stress. So that is stress for sure. But there's another kind of stress that a lot of us aren't aware of that is just as important as a psychological stress. And that is what we call physiological stress. And or you can kind of think of as psychological stress as being stress in the mind. Mm-hmm. And physiological stress is stress in the body. So if you have an illness, either, you know, an acute illness or a chronic illness, that is a stressor. So your brain and your endocrine system, all your hormones, your whole body, your immune system responds as if you're stressed, even if you think you're not stressed psychologically. So those are these two types of stress. It's really important to realize That if you have something going on with your body, even, you know, fibromyalgia, or if you have fatigue or sleep loss or some of these kinds of things, if you're not getting enough sleep, that's a stressor. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of different kinds of stress. It's interesting, you know, I like to tell my students and anyone who will listen that everything affects everything else. Mm-hmm. We used to kind of think of the mind as this thing that's even separate from our body and our brain, and our body just walks our mind around, and we don't really think of how much that affects how much they interact with each other. Mm-hmm. And so normally we have this process called homeostasis, where that is just all the things that go on in the mind and the brain, the body, that collaborate to keep us healthy, to keep our functioning within normal range.
So that kind of keeps us in balance.
It keeps us in balance. That's really what homeostasis is balance. Mm-hmm. And so the gut brain really needs to have everything in balance for it to be able to do the things that it does, to be able to digest our food. It also has interactions with our microbes, gut microbes. Some of your audience may have heard about our gut microbiome and how these little bugs have a lot of influence on our functioning, and they have a very big effect on the gut brain. Mm-hmm. And there's another aspect of this, the gut barrier. Mm-hmm. So that's really just a little bit of one line of cells that separates us from the outside world on the inside. Mm-hmm. So we also like to say we're all donuts, right? We have
right.
an outside. We have an outside on the inside. And then so our gut brain has to, you know, sort of keep everything in balance there. So we have to play nice with the gut microbes. They have to play nice with us. Mm-hmm. We also have a lot of immune cells. You know, most of the immune cells in our body really are in our gut. And that's because it's so huge.
Wow.
It's huge. And it has this big role of kind of keeping us from things, toxins, and aggressive microbes. It needs to.
So we have to be nice to our gut.
That's right. We really do, because it's playing such an important role. And the gut brain plays a very big role in coordinating all of that. Mm-hmm. So it works with the immune system. And it also has to help keep that gut barrier, because that's also where we absorb all our food from. Mm-hmm. So when we eat the food, it goes down into the tube, and then it has to get into our bodies through this. Mm-hmm. And so that gut barrier has to be able to absorb food and keep toxins and other bad things out. Mm-hmm. The gut brain plays a big role in monitoring that. So when you're stressed, some of the stress hormones can dysregulate just how those neurons work. It also can dysregulate how the immune system works, and it can increase inflammation. Right. And then that tends to also dysregulate the gut brain. And so then as one of the things I like to talk about also is how, in addition to digesting our food, the gut does, it has a really interesting and increasingly being appreciated roles in controlling things like our moods and our thinking.
Right.
And so we often don't realize when we're stressed, and maybe we think we're handling it, but if our gut and our gut brain is suffering from all this, it can sort of feed back to our brain to make us more depressed.
Right.
Especially anxiety is a big thing that seems to go along with gut problems. Fatigue is really common, and what we call cognitive fuzziness, mm-hmm. which is just memory. You know, memory is kind of bad. You have trouble focusing on things, and, you know, that's a stressor by itself, because mm-hmm. you feel like it's not centered. You know, in order to be able to stay healthy in our mind and in our body, we really need to be in balance. We need to be able to be in touch with all that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then you explain how do gut microbes affect your health. I mean, that is pretty much the involvement that all of this that you've been talking about. But tell us a little bit more. How do gut microbes affect your health directly in ways that we don't know about? This is your host, Rebecca. And now we will take a short break, and we will be right back with more ideas on lifestyle improvement.
A unique and specialized approach to spinal care is what you will find in the Advanced Spinal Care Clinic in Graham, Washington. Here's Dr. Craig Lipinski explaining why Nuke Care is unlike any other treatment.
Our goal is that we're making a specialized correction to the skull, the atlas, and the neck of each individual that is custom made or custom and specific created to get them healthy and then have them stay that way.
One of only 23 board-certified Nuke practitioners in the world, Dr. Craig Lipinski offers you care that can significantly impact your health in positive ways.
This week we've seen somebody in here who's had a 50-point drop in blood pressure by having the skull, atlas, neck corrected to a proper position.
To find out more about how NucaCare can change your life, visit www.nuccawashington.com or call 253-445-8181.
Tell us a little bit more. How do gut microbes affect your health directly in ways that we don't know about?
This is a really new field. We've known that there are microbes in our gut for a long, 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 long time. And we just assumed that they didn't do any kind of interaction with us. And all they did was digest the things that we didn't eat, eat our garbage, basically. And maybe some of them we knew they made vitamins for us, vitamin K and a few other things microbes did. So we considered, well, you know, we had this sort of symbiotic relationship. Mm-hmm. We give them a nice place to live, and, right? And they make some things for us, and that's really great. What we didn't realize was that they are in active communication with our gut barrier, with the immune system, probably with the gut brain itself, and also with the nerves that connect the gut to the brain. So they can have direct influence on our brain functioning. Mm-hmm. But even then, it seems it gets even more interesting. The gut microbes seem to play a role in controlling brain development. And so we need to keep our gut microbes happy. Basically, we have to have a healthy relationship with them.
How does that connection happen?
You know, we really don't know. We have some hypotheses. We're not sure because, you know, we used to assume that all of the interactions of gut microbes with ourselves would be pathological. And that was the assumption, but that didn't really fit with a lot of the things that we found out. We found that you could have infections with microbes that really weren't infections. You know, you would just have sort of an imbalance and what we call dysbiosis, where they're not infecting us. They're not going in there and causing a lot of damage or anything, but they're just not right. And that seems to cause some kind of imbalance in signals that signal the nervous system. So subsequently, some work in a field called metabolomics. And this is just where you just take the gut bugs and you figure out, you know, what are they making? I mean, what do they do? We know that they can make things and they release these things into, you know, our gut. What are they? And the interesting thing is they're hormones that can interact receptors in our bodies, and even neurotransmitters. There are neurotransmitters that the immune system can respond to, as well as the neurons in the gut brain have receptors for these neurotransmitters.
So much stuff.
Yeah. And so they can also have receptors for things that we produce. So we have this kind of bi-directional relationship with them all the time. And there's so many of them. And, you know, it seems like, you know, every week I see another paper about how when in the circumstances of disease, like type 2 diabetes, like metabolic syndrome, like heart disease, like obesity, like autism, like even schizophrenia. And people just go and they look at the populations of the gut bugs and they find that those are not in balance.
Wow.
And so it seems to be like a hallmark of diseases is that we have an imbalance in the populations of gut bugs that we have and in our relationship with them.
So much stuff that is interconnected. That is huge. That is huge because it really gives us the awareness of how much attention we need to be putting on this, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the exciting things now, too, is our recognition that we have more control over our gut bugs than we thought, or who our gut bugs are. Mm-hmm. We used to sort of think, well, whoever they were, and they would just be who they were. And so there was a lot of skepticism about things like probiotics. Mm-hmm. And part of this was because we didn't have any way of knowing who the gut bugs were. And we had to be able to just take essentially poop samples and culture them. And gut bugs don't like to live in a culture dish. They like to live in our gut. And so there were only a few species, and they tend to be not the nicest ones that are able to live in a dish. Now we have these DNA techniques where we can actually find out exactly who's there. And we found that it's not just the colon that they like to live in, but they also live in the small intestine and in the stomach normally. And so some of those, the populations can be influenced by our diet. So people who eat a lot of protein or people who eat a lot of animal fat will have a different population of gut microbes than people who eat a lot of plants, people who eat a lot of sugar and refined carbohydrates like white flour and things like that will have a different population of gut bugs than people who are eating more whole grains and more fresh vegetables and things like that.
So in other words, be aware of what you're eating because you are feeding your gut bugs.
Exactly. You're encouraging certain ones.
So you've given us a lot of information on the gut bugs and the interaction with health. What are some of the disorders that affect the gut secondary to stress or microbial imbalance? And how can one become more aware of when there is a potential problem?
There's a lot of ways you can know there's a potential problem, just because the gut microbes and our gut health affect so much else. So if you have fatigue, unexplained fatigue, if you're having anxiety especially, there seems to be sort of a special relationship between problems in the gut mm-hmm. and the experience of anxiety. And I think it's sort of a feeling of something's not right. A lot of what anxiety is about is something's not right. You worry mm-hmm. that something's not right, something bad might happen, but there's something that's not right. And so when there's something not right in the gut, it doesn't have a way of telling us, oh, I have inflammation, or you ate too much fat and I can't deal with it, or, I have the wrong kind of gut bugs. It can't tell us anything mm-hmm. that specific, but it can send signals saying something's not right. Something's not right. And so you can have this feeling of anxiety, especially if it's unexplained anxiety. If there's you don't have any reason to really feel this anxious, but you have it. Free-floating anxiety can be a signal. Of course, gut cramping and gut pain is also sort of common. Bloating, gas. A lot of us have that anyway. But if you have an inordinate amount of it, that would be a sign that there's something that's really not right.
And I think those are kind of common problems.
They sure are. Well, it's interesting. Just the phenomenon of dysbiosis is quite common. I think partly because of the kind of diets that so many of us eat. There's been, in the past 50 years or so, there's been a movement towards highly refined food, easy to manufacture food. It's nice that we're kind of moving away and moving back into whole foods. But there's also the phenomenon of antibiotic treatments. Mm-hmm. One of the lovely things about antibiotics is that they save people's lives. Back in before in the 1930s and 1940s, you expected to lose children to childhood diseases. You expected to lose your spouse often to pneumonia, to all these kinds of infections. And antibiotics have saved so many lives. It's incredible. Unfortunately, they have been overused. When people not realizing the difference between a virus and a bacteria. And so antibiotics don't help viruses, but it can change the population of bugs that you have so that the ones that are in your gut are ones that are resistant. And that's caused some problems you may have heard about. A lot of people are worried about what are we going to do when we have some of these very serious illnesses that are antibiotic resistant. For most of us, we haven't taken that many antibiotics, but every time we take antibiotics, it does change the population of gut bugs. Usually they bounce back to most extent, as nearly as anyone could ever tell. They do seem to come back after a few weeks. The problem is that the bugs that are most susceptible to antibiotics are the ones that seem to be the ones that are most helpful for us. And so that can cause some problems. For people who have to be on antibiotics repeatedly, is really where you start to see a problem. Because if you have to take antibiotics within a few months of having taken a big round before, the one study that I've seen about this showed that the gut bugs just did not come back. And so there were reduced populations, numbers of them, and then not as many different species. And that's important because the studies that we've seen so far really point to a theme in that diversity is good. You want to have a lot of different types of gut bugs. They all need to be in balance, and they all seem to be, many even of some of the microbes we think of as being bad, seem to play a healthy role as long as they're in balance. And so if you have enough of these other guys around, that keeps you healthy.
That is so important to know, and to know how it affects your body and how that can have a long-term effect as well. Now, some of the studies that you have done and some of the findings that you have are concerning Alzheimer's and autism related to gut health are very, very important. Okay. And, keeping in mind then by 2050, the population that is going to be suffering from this is going to explode. To know this information now, it's crucial. What do you have to tell us?
Well, there's sort of a hallmark, a link. Again, as I mentioned, everything affects everything else. And understanding what's going on in our gut and our interactions with our microbes is really critical. And this is, I think, where we can sort of bring the role of stress in, because stress dysregulates the immune system. It dysregulates the endocrine system. And all these things can feed back to interact with our neuronal functioning and our gut bugs and the way that we interact with them. Mm-hmm. And especially the increase in inflammation, as you may know, inflammation is something that we are realizing is a hallmark of all chronic disease. Mm-hmm. And it seems to play a particularly important role in neurodegenerative diseases, especially Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. We know that the brain is inflamed in Alzheimer's disease. And we know that the way the immune cells in the brain are not really responding to that particularly well. I'm seeing the story with Alzheimer's disease as well as other neurodegenerative diseases. It's getting interesting from the perspective of psychoneuroimmunology, in that there seems to be something related to microbes and host defense not being regulated properly in the context of these diseases. And this is a developing story. But for instance, exposure to parasites, some bacteria like the spirochetes, seems to increase your propensity or your risk for having Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease. And but we're all exposed to all of these things all the time. So why do some people have a problem with this and others don't? And there may be a genetic link to it, but that's not very, very close. I mean, there are in some cases of Alzheimer's disease, it's very genetic, and those people tend to develop Alzheimer's disease when they're young. But for most of us, you know, it's after the age of 65 or 70 that you start to see an increase. And so the exciting thing for me about this is once we start to understand these interactions, we may have some way of being able to manage the disease better and maybe even be able to stop it.
Yes, that's definitely for sure.
I sure hope so.
Yes. And I think either way, what is important is to know factors that can improve your chances.
Yes. And so as far as that goes, it's interesting. And it leads back to sort of that general healthy lifestyle idea, that the things that we're learning more about, what do you have to do to be stress resilient? What do you have to do to be healthy? Healthy aging is something that we're learning a lot about. There's been a lot of effort in studying some of these things. And a lot of it is a bit intuitive. But I like the idea of doing these studies and really laying it out there so that people are motivated. So one of the big issues is stress management, of course, because stress can increase inflammation and dysregulate everything. We also know that as far as Alzheimer's is concerned, you know, if you are someone who is actively involved in your world, so if you have good social contacts, social support network, either people that you have good relationships with your family, with your church, people you know in your church, people who share your interests that you get together with and you have happy, you know, happy and supportive relationships, this is protective. People who stay intellectually active. There's sort of an idea that, you know, even if you're going to develop Alzheimer's disease, if you have been taking care of your brain, you may develop it still, but it may be 10 years later than you would have otherwise. And so even if you're someone who didn't have the opportunity to go to college, for instance, and so a lot of times people worried, well, you know, didn't have access to all that. If you can stay active, reading books, the internet, actually, they've discovered that in older people who are using computers tends to help make you more resistant to dementia and loss of cognitive function as we age. So staying in contact, keeping your brain active, the more, you know, use it or lose it is what we say, use it or lose it. And so all these things, physical activity, we also know is very important. And it doesn't have to be really strenuous physical activity, but it's sort of avoiding being sedentary. So not sitting around all the time. You know, even for those of us who have jobs where we have to sit around a lot, even if you can get up for 5 minutes an hour and walk around. Things like gardening counts as exercise. You know, I think that we know that gardening certainly seems to be protective, especially in older people. So older people who garden tend to have fewer serious health problems. And, you know, I think as someone who loves to garden, I think part of it is, you know, you do get out there, you're using your muscles, but, right. You know, the sort of planting the plants and nurturing those plants and seeing them grow and seeing them have flowers or, you know, fruit and eating the vegetables from them, it just gives you a good feeling. And we know that good feelings are really good. That's one thing that helps protect against stress, is having these happy, you know, normal, rewarding kinds of situations are really good for us. And gardening, a lot of people garden. There's lots of gardening groups, garden clubs, you know, even internet groups of people who like plants, you know, so that gives you, you know, a bunch of other people to talk about something that you like about. And like in my garden, I love to walk around my garden. I walk around it every day. And I look at all the plants that my friends have given me, and it reminds me of my friends. And it makes me think, oh, that was so nice of her to give me this plant. And it gives me these good feelings, which are really, really good for your body. It's good for your mind, good for your immune system.
Absolutely.
Well, you know, it seems like sometimes in our culture, we have this sort of grimness that, you know, we're not supposed to enjoy things too much. You know, we're supposed to work really hard and be very serious. And we're not supposed to just take some time out and enjoy things and appreciate things. But it turns out from the perspective of the body, it's very important to do those things.
Take the time to take care of yourself.
Exactly.
And gardening is an absolutely wonderful activity that caregivers can do with the people that they care for.
It's really true. I have a friend who is an occupational therapist who works in a rehabilitation facility, and they have gardens, and you know, it's a wonderful thing to work with people there, enjoy, because it's something that, you know, you can sort of see, you know, you can just experience in the moment, I suppose. And, you know, for people who have dementia, that, you know, they live in the moment. And so to spend your time in the moment with them is good for you as well as for them.
And remember that in our program, we present our opinion and the opinion of our guest, and is not to be interpreted as medical advice.
And that concludes part one of our interview with Dr. Lisa Gaylor. Dr. Gaylor is part of the faculty at the University of Virginia School of Nursing. She also has a PhD in psychology from UCLA, where she studied gut and liver interactions with the brain. Thank you for joining us today here on Lifestyle Improvement. And don't forget to tune in again next Sunday morning at 7:30 for part two of our interview with Dr. Lisa Gaylor.